Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. Here on a Sunday morning, we'll start off with what is the United Lodge of Theosophists. We are a group and organism, a family of individuals devoted to the study of the philosophy of theosophy. And theosophy is a very much a defined body of knowledge as the writings, as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. The purpose of the lodge here, as we study independently devoted to it, as well as the lodge being devoted to it as an independent lodge, not subsumed or overseen by any other lodge. This is entirely independent. The purpose for the lodge is to make sure that these ideas, the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, are kept before the public. These are ancient ideas. We can even say these are timeless ideas. And the more one studies them, the more it becomes evident that this is just a part of who the human being is. It is a system of universal thought and the study of all the world's religions and philosophies to show the common principles behind all of them. So the work that we do here, being independently devoted as we are, we have a common purpose, a common aim, purpose, and teaching. That's what forms the bond among ULT students. It's not an oath. It's not dues. There's no positions that people, there are no elected officers, et cetera, et cetera. It's a matter of, have you found that the philosophy of theosophy can be a living power in your life? Or are you on the path toward testing it, checking it, verifying it? And if so, you're welcome to associate with the lodge. We don't even like the word requirement, but we would say that unless your objective sincerely is to prove to yourself the reality of universal brotherhood and to grow in a conviction of a profounder sense of universal brotherhood, if that's not your objective, you're still welcome to come. But you're probably not going to be around here for very long because you'll find that the purpose of the lodge is inconsistent with why ever you're here. So, that being the case, the lodge, every week we have two meetings. The meetings are open to all and are free to all. As we said, there's no fees or dues. But we do accept gratefully contributions of time, money, and service. All are needed. Anybody who you see here who is working at the book table or in the library or giving talks, nobody's paid 5 cents to do this. Any contributions that you would make literally go to keeping the lights on, to keeping the air conditioning on. That's where the money goes. We have two meetings each week on a Sunday morning. The one starts at 11 a.m. and the doors open at 10:30. You're certainly welcome to come at 10:30. Each Sunday during the summer, at least for July and September, we've been studying karma. It's been a summer of karma. And how fascinating that we can continue to study karma in so many different aspects. The source of the material we're using is from an article written by Mr. Judge called Aphorisms on Karma. By the way, the source of all the material that is used in any of these meetings is the original teachings of the philosophy of theosophy by Mr. Judge and H.P. Blavatsky. So Aphorisms on Karma each Sunday through the summer, well, during July and during September. During August, we're taking Sundays off. Every August, we take Sundays off. Okay. Then on Wednesday evenings, we also have weekly meetings. The doors open at 5:15 because there's a library that's available to the public. It's open at 5:15 to 7:15, and we have a a book table that's open during library hours and before and after meetings with all Streetline Theosophical literature, which is available to the public at the cost that the lodge purchases it at. And we just overheard a conversation, oh, such and such increased by 25 cents, but we have 1,000 of them, these pamphlets. So we're just going to keep the price the same until the next batch comes in. When we start paying more, we charge more. There's no profit, even to the point of 25 cents. Okay. So Wednesdays, the doors open at 5:15, and that's the library time, 5:15 to 7:15. You can come to the library. We're studying the Bhagavad Gita each Wednesday evening. When you come to the library, you can come early if you care to study the part, read the part, discuss what's going on in the part before the meeting. Or if there's something that has piqued your interest in any, you know, in life or in any of these other meetings, and you want to look it up, what does Theosophy have to say about that? You come on in. There's always a student in the library available to help you search or to maybe point you in the direction that might be of service. So, without further ado, any contributions that one feels the spirit, if the spirit moves you so, you're certainly welcome to talk with the person at the book table before or after the meetings about that. Also, Wednesday evenings, we have been studying the Bhagavad Gita each Wednesday through the summer, and which is, of course, a treatise, a world-renowned treatise on what we call Eastern psychology, you know, understanding the inner nature of ourselves. It's all about ethics, ethics, ethics. So without further ado, we are now going to invite a fellow volunteer who has prepared a brief talk on today's three aphorisms on karma, which if you do we all have a sheet? It might be helpful if you want. There's some in the back. If you don't have one, you can get one. So we'll have them this talk given, and then after that, there's plenty of time for talk, discussion, and questions.
So the aphorisms we're going to be looking at today are 14, 15, and 16. And what we're going to do is read each one separately, but as will be seen, they can be read as like one continuous sentence, because the three of them kind of build on each other. So after we read them, you know, I'll just say a few words about how they all fit together and what the main idea is. So 14, in the life of worlds, races, nations, and individuals, karma cannot act unless there is an appropriate instrument provided for its action. 15, and until such appropriate instrument is found, that karma related to it remains unexpended. While a man is experiencing karma in the instrument provided, his other unexpended karma is not exhausted through other beings or means, but is held in reserve for future operation. And lapse of time during which no operation of that karma is felt causes no deterioration in its force or change in its nature. So some people think that what I do now, if I do something wrong now, think something, it doesn't have to just be an action. It can be a thought without an action as well. That the payment I will have to make for that will happen in my next life. But that's not the way it works. Karma is not linear. the things that we are experiencing now can be as a result of a life, maybe four, five, six, even more lives previous to this. But what these three aphorisms are basically saying is that, for one, there has to be an instrument, a form, in order to perform that action that is coming to them from a previous karma. And until it has to be an appropriate form and an appropriate life in order for that karma to work. It depends upon the lesson that has to be learned. And there's an attraction when, after the after-death states have been accomplished, there's a magnetic attraction that brings forth that new soul into the form that will be the appropriate manifestation of that karma for that lifetime, if that makes sense. So until that appropriate form is attracted, well, the soul attracted to that form, that karma, it says, until the appropriate instrument or form is found, that karma related to it remains unexpended. So we're not working on all the karma that we have to deal with. I mean, that would be an impossibility, because we've had so many issues in the past. So what is kind of waiting in the wings when this new life is happening now, the strength of those impressions will not weaken, even if it's like four or five lifetimes in the future. That will have to be satisfied, and it will be satisfied at some point in time, and it will not lessen. If that karmic result will not lessen, no matter how long it is, because the universe has to balance things out. And just because it's taking a while for that to manifest in a lifetime doesn't mean we're not going to have to pay for it. Let's see. So we think we can. So, and number 14 talks about in the life of worlds, races, nations, and individuals, right? So it's not just the human that is being the individual person, but we are living here in the United States because this is our karma. We are living in Philadelphia or surrounding areas, wherever we're coming from, because it's our karma. And we're in a family because of our karma. So we can see that we're going from universals to particulars because we're on this earth at this particular time. We're in this solar system at this particular time. So wherever we are here because it's our karma to be here at this time.
So we could start this off with any contributions or questions regarding karma. Yes?
It's the word instrument. Does that mean the physical body only?
Does the word instrument here mean the physical body only? Only is a pretty big word, but I think that the focus here is the instrument, simply because, you know, it's really the plane of perception that we're operating on normally as a race right now is the physical plane. And so we think what Mr. Judge is talking about is on the physical level. That's not, however, to say that karma is limited to the physical body. It also affects, we're obviously affected karmically, we're affected emotionally, we're affected mentally, psychically, He talks about the moral plane. So, you know, karma can affect us in all ways. So probably if something is affecting us physically, that's the effect of other causes, and there's probably more going on within that we might be open to. Yes?
Well, we were thinking a person may have a wonderful, wonderful physical health and be very, very successful, and is suddenly hit with depression or loses all their money or their reputation. So although the instrument is the personal life, the instrument can be our emotional nature, or in the case of races and nations, the political atmosphere. So we think instrument's a very broad word.
Okay, thank you. So yeah, so we'll consider instrument for the purposes of this discussion, whatever it is that's being affected. And in certain ways, a family can have karma. And in that sense, the family would be the instrument through which the karma works, through which every individual in the karma shares. Yes?
Yeah, hi. If we attract certain things to us in karma, I had a life 10 times, God, I'd say, I'm attracting something today. I just had a question I heard in the news. How does a 7-year-old girl attract a sexual assault? Is that something?
How does a 7?
I heard a thing on the news where there was a 7-year-old girl that attracted, she had a sexual assault by her. Is that based on somebody else's free will, or did she actually do something in a lifetime where she would attract that to her?
Oh, okay. So, yeah. So let's look at the theosophical view of when a child is abused. What did that little girl do to make her warrant this? She's done nothing. She does not deserve that per se. In that lifetime, who's ever to say? There's a lot of things that are coming at the race karmically. Who among us can say why she was put in that position with those challenges, those stresses? We can't know the answer to that question, but we can know that that little girl, that 7-year-old little girl, is also an ancient soul. And we are born into each life with a character developed at a level that can handle every lesson presented to us. Do we handle every lesson right the first time? Probably not. But when and where that happens, the teaching is, you know, one of weaker character is not going to be subject to great challenges until such time that they've built their character. And the more so, sometimes when we build, you know, sometimes people may think they're getting through a lot of karma here, and so it's going to be over and life's going to be easy, and they may have accomplished certain things and gotten through a lot of karma. But what they've done at the same time is they've grown in certain ways in their character, and now they're ready to take on even more from previous times. We can't say any specifics about this little girl other than to say there's no way the philosophy could say she brought it on herself. It simply doesn't work that way. That's not to say that she can't use that experience sometime to benefit. Yes, in the corner. Thank you. So the contribution here is, and we're going to change it just a little bit to get on a slightly different track. Let's say we have a child who's born with certain special needs, and the needs of this child require sacrifice from the entire family. And this little baby girl is suffering in certain ways every day just to get through her day. Well, what did she do to acquire that? We can't say, on the one hand. Well, let's just say she's there as an opportunity, for the rest of the family to grow in compassion. Maybe that is step one in certain growth patterns for her brothers and sisters, to sacrifice the time and the love that they would otherwise get from their parents because they know their parents have to focus on the little girl so much. So we can't always know, but we have to be broad-minded and open-minded. Now, with theosophy, you know, we hear about the mind, the heart doctrine and the head doctrine. You know, to the extreme, the head doctrine would be saying, well, if someone got this and this happened to them, well, that's their karma, and, you know, good luck with that. That's not me. See ya. You know, yeah, but really, that's not theosophy. That's what Mr. Judge calls mechanistic theosophy, and it's just not the reality. You have to put heart in it. And, you know, if we're studying theosophy without blending the soul, compassion of the soul into what we're doing, you know, even at risk of making a mistake, at least we're putting ourselves in a position of sacrifice to be of service, you know, then maybe the study of theosophy just isn't, if we're going to take it from that perspective, because it can be twisted. There's been a hand here. Yes.
So, after death, after we go through the death experiences, our karma, our soul, is waiting for the form. And we could be waiting like a real short period of time or a long period of time for that, for our karma to seek out that next form. Is that what we're saying here?
The question is, after death, are we basically suspended waiting to be reborn to pick up where we left off? Essentially, yes, but karma has not yet fully expanded. Just because the physical body dies does not mean that the karma of that life is expended.
Okay.
So what's going on then with the death of the body? You know, while we're here in the physical world, that we create, there's cause and effect. We can get things moving and we can react to certain things that are coming our way. After the death of the body, this cause and effect process actually ceases, because we don't set up causes after death. The after death state is an effect state where we continue to perhaps reflect, to grow from, to live out the unexpected, the unexpended or unexhausted highest ideals and aspirations of what we thought of ourselves as a personality. You know, because when the physical body dies, our ideas and our dreams don't die with it. They are still real. And depending on how much time, effort, energy we put into creating that balloon of ideas, that influences how long our life between physical bodies is going to be until those ideas are fully expended, which is why the sages say, look, focus on what you're doing. Look at the highest purpose of what you're doing. Fulfill your life's purpose and actually do it. The more we dream about, oh, what I would be if I didn't have to do this, all we're doing is setting up a longer amount of time that we're going to be floating out elsewhere by ourselves, living in this false reality until those ideas are expended and we've experienced all of it, because we've created it on that plane. So if the student of theosophy recognizes only here can I really get stuff done, then the idea would be, well, let's get stuff done while we're here and stop fantasizing, and that way we'll minimize. The effect could be to minimize. It's not like we have to plan it out. It's not like we're going to schedule it. But living our lives according to certain principles will result in us having greater opportunity to be of greater service. Yes?
That was so very, very well put. It should be written down somewhere as a better explanation of Devakam. And we wanted to remind, especially newcomers, that this meeting will be, what are they called? A podcast, which you can go into our website by next Sunday. You can listen to this meeting or share it with others.
Great.
But we wanted to go back for a second. There's the double aspect of considering someone else's karma. HPB says very definitely there is not a moment or an accident in our lives that isn't directly our own karma. But, as you said, there's the heart aspect of it. It may be the karma of that soul incarnated in that little girl body to have that horrible event, but we don't know whether it's something she did or maybe something she didn't do. Maybe she was the parent of a child who claimed to be abused and the mother didn't or father didn't accept it. So it's a lesson, but we don't know the level at which the lesson has to be. So there's no judgment.
Certainly.
There's just the sympathy and compassion, but it is that soul's karma. And if they can deal with it, as you said, they move on.
Thank you. And when so when explaining these such an situation, we have to explain it carefully and fully, because only in the light of the soul being immortal and being fully responsible for everything, only in that light can the theosophical perspective be seen as not being cruel. That happening is, you know, it's not for a theosophist, it's not that we're being cold, oh, she deserved it, or oh, she earned it, or something, because that little girl didn't, that little personality didn't earn that. But something about those people, that situation, creates the conditions where this event can be, obviously, some kind of a breakthrough that's needed, and it's a sacrifice, no matter how we look at it, it's a sacrifice by the little girl. Not something that a seven-year-old girl chose, but we have to view all human beings as self-conscious, immortal beings, and so we don't always have the answers to these things. Yes?
The third aphorism today, the end of it says, lapse of time during which no operation of that karma is felt causes no deterioration in its force or change in its nature. So we realize it may not take place for 3-4 lifetimes down the road. But does that mean that when it does, that we have, since there's no deterioration in its force or change in its nature, have we developed a stronger, better instrument in the interim, so that then we are therefore able to take it, whatever lessons we need to learn?
We think the answer is in the question. And in that sense, the universe is merciful, and we say the universe in the sense of the law is merciful, universally speaking. An example of that, universally speaking, for all of mankind, is there's certain things that with certain causes we set up in Atlantis, the likes of which we, right now, for all of us, we really don't even know, but it is of great magnitude. And if allowed, that the effect of that would have wiped this out completely, even today. Yet, there are forces in place, there are universal processes in place where the effects of those causes are not going to reach us until when? Until the instrument is ready. Not to be annihilated, that's not what karma is for. Until the instrument is ready to learn from the lesson from the effects. So, as far as Atlantis, from what we understand, we have to achieve a certain level of knowledge, power, scientific ability to be able to handle the effect of that karma on the level where we were as Atlanteans when we set it up. Otherwise, what's it all for? Karma is not to destroy the human race. It's so that we can learn. And these are, it's coming, we think. You know, if we look at some of the games that we're playing on the genetic level, we're learning things that HPB, if you take a look at what she had to say in Atlantis, it's very interesting. Now, there have been hands. Yes. We have to please repeat the sentence and speak loud.
To make
than anything to participate in this great evolutionary cycle.
Thank you. Yes, this
and the harmony, disturbed harmony, we should want to restore.
So this contribution really is, you know, the purpose for karma is to restore harmony on the individual level, on the level of the human being, for the whole world. It's to restore harmony that was put out of place. So it's our individual responsibility to participate in the restoration of harmony, which sometimes means when you see your karma coming back at you, accept it and take responsibility for it. That's an opportunity to restore harmony that you put out of place. On the other side, though, yes, we're here because of our imperfections. Yes, we're here to learn lessons. But we're also here because the lower kingdoms cannot evolve any further without our help. So the karma of contributing to the evolution of all of life around us, that's available to us to participate in. We're responsible for that too. So that's the invitation. Yes?
And I think what people often register out of that remark is how we treat animals. You know, are we respectful with things? But it's our own physical body represents those kingdoms as well. So if we are, I can't think of an example. If we're clumsy and then we get mad about everything, we have just impressed nature with all that ugliness, and it has to do something with it. So we're responsible in ways that we don't even see for the lower kingdoms.
Thank you for the contribution.
I know,
sir.
It's confusing, wasn't it?
No, we get it. We get it. Yes?
Question. When we refer to karma, is it always past life karma, or is it ever karma of your same life, something you did 20 years ago, or that would just be a different?
Really, no. Cause and effect is cause and effect. I mean, what's the karma of putting your hand on the fry pan? Right? Pretty much immediate. So, what we find interesting and is reiterated here is the fact that, so to speak, you know, it never goes away until it's addressed. You know, even if it did happen in previous lives, it doesn't dissipate. You don't get a flavor of what kind of it was like. No, you get, apparently, the lesson. Yes?
One way of saying it is physical karma is immediate in every kingdom, ours included. In the human kingdom, there's will and choice, and moral karma is the sticking ground.
So physical karma, generally speaking, is an immediate experience. But moral karma, because of the human being's choice of what? Choice of why he's, not just what we're physically doing, but why we're doing it, what's motivating us to do it, how much do we know about what we're doing? If someone gets hurt and we darn well know that they would because of our action, as opposed to another person who did the same thing but didn't realize what the effect would be, the karma of those are not exactly the same. The response on the physical plane might be the exact same physical response, but on moral planes, it could be different. Here's an example. We have, and we've heard this before, it's a wonderful example. So we have two young ladies alike in so many ways. They're both 18 years old. They are both going for the Olympic gold record, gold medal. One lives in a small Eastern European country. One lives in the United States of America. They both want that gold medal. Now, on the physical plane, that's pretty much the same thing. They both go to the same Olympic stadium and do the competition at the same time in the same, say, gymnastics. But what's motivating the one is the fact that she knows she's going to get her face on the box of Wheaties in every grocery store in the United States and probably a $10 million contract to advertise Adidas. The other one is moved to do this because she knows if she gets that gold medal, that is going to impact all of her nation in such a way, especially the girls of her nation, the little girls watching her as an example, and that's what's driving her. Now, let's say they both get a gold medal in that Olympics. What's the karma of both of them? We're not saying one's right, one's wrong. We're saying what motivated them on the moral plane, what motivated them to do it, was different, so that even on the physical plane, they both got the consequences. They both got the... There are other, much more broad, wide-ranging consequences on different levels. So karma can be complicated. We can only talk about it in terms of principles and examples and ideas. One has to use one's own intuition as best we can to try to get a clue on what it's all about us, our own. No one else can tell you what the karma of your soul is. There was a hand here. Yes. Yeah.
Where does unexpended karma get stored? Is there some plane where it's stored?
Yeah.
Some cosmic hard drive?
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's probably an answer to that. We would say, and then we'll open it up, that it's not a time and place thing, but there is what we call the astral plane, that where everything is recorded. Sometimes we'll refer to it as the Akasha, which is the highest. Not everything gets recorded, only the highest there. But there is this, non-physical recording that's done of everything. We don't mean to make it sound like Santa Claus checking off his box, but it's there, yeah.
Okay, take
help.
An oak tree. An oak tree drops acorns. The conditions might not be right for any one of them to develop, but they're there. They are seeds. In that metaphor, we, as a soul, are the oak tree. The acorns are the unexpended karma. Where are they recorded? In us. We have no idea that we are huge, magnetic, dynamic mind beings that possess every power we've ever thought of in nature and in life that we accredit to a God. We are that. So we carry all of that karma within us. In that sense, we are karma, and that's why there's no escape. It is you yourself that is the judge, the prosecutor, the defense lawyer. It's everybody. So it has to happen because the seeds are in you. And when the soil is right, the conditions are right, there you go, another oak tree.
Thank you. So this explanation is saying, really, where does this unexpended karma exist? Well, unexpended karma is potential. It's possibility. It's going to happen. But the instrument has to be provided. Well, that potential is still in you. You're the creator of it. So if we're the creator of it, then it is resident in our being. And it is resident in the immortal portion or part of it, principle of our being. It doesn't die with the body. People think, oh, well, I'll get forgiven. And when I die, I'll go to heaven. It'll be all over. It doesn't matter. Not true. Theosophically speaking, in the light of theosophy, those seeds reside in the immortal soul. Now, come time when the immortal soul, after death, through the after-death stages, when they're finished experiencing life as that person who died, which can take up to 1,500 years, the seeds of all past lives are still there, and there's a magnetism to them. And what happens metaphorically is something's going on the physical plane with people, families, nations, things, opportunities, and where there are, at that time, in that situation, where there are magnetic seeds that are, universally speaking, the best place for the individual to be born into because of the corresponding magnetic opportunities. That's what brings us back. It's not a matter of, oh, I think I'll have Mary and Bob as my parents. No, we go back to the perfect opportunity in the time and space that will be the next step for the evolution or the learning of our soul. Yes, in the back.
Those seeds that are being spoken up, are we looking at those as being skandhas?
Are we looking at those? Are we looking at those seeds as being skandhas? So, of course, we're talking metaphysics, and so it can be they're related. They're at least, if they're not the same thing, they're related. We understand skandhas to be, you know, a perpetual, you know, we have patterns that are waiting to for us because we set certain patterns in motion, and skandhas are patterns in a given life that that we kind of marry with. It's a metaphysical idea for the patterns of our life. So skandhas are definitely associated, you know, they are associated with karma. Skandhas might be those seeds, we don't know. So maybe that's something we could ask elsewhere. This hand has been up, yeah. And then, sorry. Wait, does this have to do with that question?
Yes. Okay.
Let's finish this up and we'll go to you. Go ahead.
Skandhas then are, in their own way, the very seeds. And in coming into an incarnation, it's what blocks some and allows some, because you have to look up where the skandhas are. There are several areas of your life. There's the mental and the physical. So you could have a perfect mind and then have a physical body where you can't use it. So you can see that the karma of having this perfect mind is really wasted. So the skandhas are, in that sense, the seeds of karma.
Thank you for the contribution. Yes, sir.
Well, this is referred to as the theosophical movement, a term that we have to think about. And at the beginning, we heard the chair go briefly over some fundamental ideas. The understanding of that from a universal point of view should give us a better foundation for considering the part that each one of us plays in this great movement.
Right. Well, so from that universal point of view, you know, we use the word universal a lot in theosophy, don't we? You know, but where are we coming from with that? Well, we have to start with our source. And on the one hand, we can say our source, and it would be true, our source is the unknowable, absolute, infinite, undescribable one, the mysterious one. That's our source. But then we have to stop there because there's nothing we can say about it because there's nothing we can know about it. It's not even manifest. It's also true if we say our source is the first emanation from that one because there's only one of them in manifestation. That first emanation we can look at, we can use the word like Maha Buddhi, universal Buddhi. Buddhi is the second principle, which is the storehouse of wisdom, the storehouse of all events, ideas, experiences from the beginning of time, so to speak. So, if we're talking universal, and each of us has in principle the same, we are identical to the universe in principle, we are a microcosm of the macrocosm, then each one of us is a reflection of the universe reflecting on itself. So, the point being, what we can say about the absolute is that it manifests on a periodic basis. And this periodic basis can be seen in nature. The law of cycles, we talk about that. Karma is directly related to cycles. Karma returns to us according to certain cycles. Some of them are quicker, such as the physical plane. Some of them takes many lifetimes, depending on the situations. But this is why we have to use different bodies in the course of evolution because these physical forms are temporary instruments for karma. If we had no karma, we would not need these forms. We are born into these forms to experience and to make karma. Okay. So the point we're trying to get to, though, is we come from the universal. We experience, you know, our wants and our needs only so that we can finally learn that we don't want or need anything because we are that, and that's the evolutionary process of the individual and of the entire human race. So it's all a universal evolutionary process, and it's all a matter of not until we learn that we all have to do it together because we're all here together, because really we are all one to begin with, you know, that is what drives evolution and support. Yeah.
Well, the absolute doesn't really manifest.
Right.
It's the causeless cause. It causes manifestation, but it remains not a part of it.
Thank you. There's manifestation which emanates from or radiates from. But don't interpret that. We have to be careful not to interpret that as, well, then that means God made the universe. No, it doesn't. It means, according to law, form comes forth. Matter comes forth. Yes?
We think the easiest way for, well, especially in the Western mind is not very intuitively sophisticated. We've never been taught or trained or encouraged. It is to think of zero. Zero is nothing. And yet, all numbers come from zero. And it doesn't matter if you start right now. You can keep adding one to the number before, or you can go in the other direction and subtract, and you will never stop. You can never stop. From nothing, comes everything into infinity. So we think that helps to go, yeah, you know what? I do understand some metaphysical things. Nothing is the absolute principle, and from it emanates everything, and back to it is returned. I can deal with metaphysics.
Thank you for the contribution. Yes?
So let's all help nature in her sacred course. Often we plant a garden, and we put it away and watch it grow, the seeds. We follow certain laws that are sit outside and we become a part by looking at what we have done in the market that is maintained by our understanding of the laws that govern each aspect of our existence. So there we have to use those terms, harmony, unity, beauty.
Thank you.
Pain and suffering, yes. But we have to rise and go.
Thank you. And so this contribution started off with, interestingly, the idea of we plant our garden and sit back and observe it grow according to certain laws. If we look at the garden as really being ourself, are we working on the garden? Do we have the proper proportions of minerals in the soil? If we don't, it's because we haven't put it there. That's our karma. What do we need to do? Do we have what kind of seeds are in there? Is it all flowers and trees, or do we have weeds? If we have weeds in our garden, it's because we allowed them to grow, right? So, so we're using the metaphor, but bring it to, ancient wisdom is more and more expressed seen talked about in modern science, and modern science will, you know, will stop and say, what we thought were the limits of an individual because of his genetic makeup, we now recognize is completely false. 5% of our genome is deterministic. You know, if you're born with a certain gene, you're going to be Down syndrome, you're going to be Down syndrome. 95% of our genome is entirely influenceable by what we do, how we think, how we feel, and the love that we have in the relationships in our life. That changes your genes. There's something called epigenetics, you may have heard it's in recent years, which is the genetics, so to speak, above and beyond what you were born with that gets passed on, which not only affects the individual, but gets passed on to your children. So there's the genes, the DNA, there's epigenetics, which is like a rebuilding of the structure of your DNA. And then there's even the microbiome, Mr. Judge calls it the lives. If you look at the Ocean of Theosophy in the chapter that talks about the physical body is not a thing. The physical body is the lives that build up this form, and each cell isn't really even a cell. It's a force in which there are atoms acting, but per se, it's not a physical thing. The message there being that the physical body, as surely as we look at it, and it's real, it's here, it's hard, it's not, you know, it's actually changing more than any other aspect of us. If the physical, which reminds us, if the physical body is changing more than any other aspect of us, then it kind of makes us think of what fire is. HPB said that fire, she described it as a kind of, it's physical, but she says fire, what we see as fire, is a process. We're observing a process. Well, it's not unreasonable if we look at our physical body and say, stop, that's not a thing the same as it was 10 minutes ago. It's a process. Our physical being is always changing. Therefore, it's either evolving, refining, or degrading. What am I doing right now in the process of living with my thoughts and feelings? Because in Western science today, we're finding out that the DNA is nothing in terms of determining what our life is going to be. And it's kind of fun to listen to scientists say this who never would have said it 20 years ago when they graduated college. Yeah.
Mr. Judge, of course, said we want to change our physical health, physical system. It's how we think attracts the materials into that frame that's called cell. So we can, by that action, by the right thought and direction of our minds and hearts, change the substance of our bodies.
So the process of this, you know, if we can change the substance of our bodies by the way that we think. The process that we've heard that went through when HBB perhaps would receive a letter from her master, it would, so to speak, materialize or precipitate. Mr. Judge says that's actually just an example of evolution going at a much, much higher speed. Well, it would seem then, really, just by changing the way we see our life, think, and feel about things, the attraction of those things that we need from wherever it is, that's magnetically precipitating the conditions that are necessary for us to grow. Hopefully the motive is right. Otherwise, we're just creating more karma for ourselves. So which tells us, you know, when we go back to the instrument, the instrument's not the physical. Let's not just look at it as the physical, because we are bigger than the confines of our skin. You know, in certain ways we are not time bound and place bound. This physical process that we know where it is, we know when it's there, but we're not limited to the boundary of our skin. And because we're not, we have access to a lot to change and influence and transmute what we're using for higher purpose. Yeah.
Yeah, it's difficult for me to think that people in here right now are not on two tracks. What do I mean? We're focusing on everything we've said and trying to bring it together and make sense of it. But at the same time, maybe thinking too much, kind of narcissistic, but it's difficult for me to think that our own problems right now in this life, today, are not somehow on that other track impinging in on what we're hearing. Now, to be only on that track all the time as we listen is to waste our time. But I, for one, am listening and I'm attempting, and I will, when I leave here and read, fit it in to my present situation. But that situation I'm faced with, and everyone, shouldn't say everyone, I can't assume it. But I wouldn't be surprised if the people here are feeling that bleed through what they're faced with right now into what we're talking about.
Oh, so the question is, or the contribution is, how practical is this that we're talking about?
Well, it's very practical.
Okay.
Sure. But at the same time, there's that gut feeling of what we're living in July of 2017.
Right.
And, I mean, I think some people, my opinion, have trouble getting onto this, the theosophical track.
Sure.
When something else is
distracting them.
Yeah, distracting them.
Well, by all means, we here are the last ones to say that you should buy everything you hear in this room hook, line, and sinker. You shouldn't. But at the same time, if we consider the source of these ideas and reflect on them, the more we think about it, the more we realize, these ideas came to us because they are, they're within us. That's why we recognize the value of them. But what's going on in our life right now, and corresponding it to what are we talking about in the lodge today? That's what the mind is all about, because what we're talking about, hopefully, in principle, can be corresponded to what we're experiencing in life. And the process of analogy and correspondence in the ancient wisdom religion is a more useful tool for learning and applying these principles than any physical science repetition. Can I recreate the physical scenario? Can I recreate? That's nothing. What we're talking about here is, what is the principle? What is the universal principle? How am I applying it in life right now? And observing and trust in the law. One thing about our mind, the more we practice something, the better we get at it. And so if we trust in the law, then the more effort we put into focusing on something, if it's true, the more we'll recognize it and see the truth of it, because a true idea, when planted in the mind in a given life, is always there and will only use your experiences to grow from, to prove the truth of it. Last question.
But the present conditions we face, whether good or bad, that's not us. Those are conditions. And we're the thinker. So we should take some time out every day to remind ourselves, I'm a fragment of the one, and I will have different conditions. Let's hope I make them well. But as far as convincing anybody else, an older student here, we heard her talking to a gentleman who was scorning reincarnation, ridiculous. And she said, well, all right, what is it right this minute? And he said, well, it's now. And she said, okay, what is it right this minute? She said, well, it's now. And she said, well, isn't it always now? And he said, well, yes. And she said, and you're here now, aren't you?
Thank you. So with that one reminder, Wednesday evenings is the Bhagavad Gita class. Second reminder is next Sunday, there's no Sunday class through the month of August. So we'll see you the first Sunday of September, and you're invited to our luncheon, as you always are, on first Sundays. Our meeting is adjourned.